Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Batter Up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 44 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-host, Linda Serovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
We are also joined this week by a very special guest, Brian Wright, author of the brand new book, The New York Mets All-Time All-Stars. Hi, Brian.
Hi, everyone. Great to be on with you.
So your book is strictly about the best Met at every position in the franchise's history. So you're trying to create sort of like a Mets All-Star team of sorts. Did any Mets surprise you when you were researching this book where you were like, oh yeah, like he was way better than I remember?
Yeah, so I created a team, a 30-man roster, and I guess the difficulty in it was like I did it by position, so I was ranking these people by position, which made it very tough, like when determining the best starting pitchers. As we all know, the Mets have had are very deep when it comes to great starting pitchers in their history, so that was tough to narrow it down, and I actually expanded it out to 7. But as far as people that surprised me, and in particular someone that I just, when I jotted down when I first started making this team in like my initial draft, and just, you know, very speed jotted people down and said, okay, this person, okay, Keith Hernandez, that's a shoo-in. Second baseman, I jotted down Daniel Murphy, and I said, he probably isn't one of them, but okay, just move on. Then I looked at Daniel Murphy, and this is funny because, you know, there are guys that I never saw. I only see through, you know, old clips or have read about through books. But Daniel Murphy is a guy I saw, we all saw, you know, firsthand. And I just didn't realize that he actually did better than I remember. We all remember what he did in October 2015 when he became a combination of like Reggie Jackson and Babe Ruth rolled into one with that home run exhibition that led him to the pennant. As well, we also remember him for his antics on the field and the base pass. I mean, antics. He was just very inconsistent. But before that, he was a very consistent hitter. I mean, he averaged about 30 doubles a year, was an all-star in 2014, and for the most part, was very, very consistent at the plate. So that was a guy that I initially was like, oh, he won't make it. And then I go, oh, he actually does. And it wasn't just because of what he did in that postseason run in 2015. He had a lot more to him.
Do you think that if Daniel Murphy, like for argument's sake, if Daniel Murphy had like re-signed with the Mets instead of signing with the Nationals, do you think that would have gotten him over the hump to be like inarguably the best second baseman in Mets history?
I mean, if he had a year like he did in Washington 2016, maybe. But
Fonzie, you can't defend Fonzie.
I know. I love Eduardo Alfonso. So obviously that's hypothetical, but I think he wanted to sign with the Mets, and it's unfortunate the Mets didn't do that. I think that was a big mistake at the time. That's just not second guessing, it's first guessing. But I do think his year was fueled a lot by revenge at the Mets' expense, and it worked out very well. But to think that if he did play for the Mets and had a season close to what he did in 2016, I mean, you take away Dana Murphy from the Nationals, put him on the Mets win the division, and who knows what happens after that. So I hate trying to think about that, but it would have been interesting. It would have been interesting to see what his impact in terms or his rank in terms of second baseman. I do love Eduardo Alfonso, and he'd be hard to top.
One of the things I think surprised me was that David Cone didn't make it into your rotation. He was an honorable mention, but I suspected like Cone was a shoo-in, and I was like, oh, I guess not. Yeah, so that kind of surprised me.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, the last, it was, I knew even when I expanded out to seven pitchers that I was going to leave one or two starting pitchers that could easily have made it and probably on other teams would have made it. I had basically had it down to four people for two spots, Ron Darling, Al Leiter, David Cone, and Sid Fernandez. And I couldn't really have a problem if you were to put Cone and Fernandez in there and not put Darling and Leiter. I put Darling in there because I think he had a, even though I didn't use length of service as the be all end all argument, he did have 99 victories, which in the 80s and in early 90s was of some importance. And 99 victories is fourth all time in Mets history. He was had a very good year in 85 that kind of got obscured by Gooden's great season in 85. And then in 86, he was also wonderful and got a lot of no decisions, but had a fantastic year. And I put that and having two very good World Series starts certainly helped as well. But yeah, Cone, it's tough to leave him off. Had a great 88, 20-3, led the league in strikeouts a lot, 19 strikeouts in a game. That was tough to leave him off. And going to Al Leiter, Leiter's numbers don't stand out, but the fact that he pitched in the steroid era, and if you kind of use the stats that balance out the eras, he stacks up pretty well in Mets history. So I went with him there, and then Sid Fernandez, who I think is underrated. I think people don't give him enough credit. I judge the pitchers in the era in which they pitched. It's kind of complicated. I obviously looked at, you know, all the eras and tried to even it out, but I examined the pitchers in the time they pitched. Like Sid Fernandez today, who normally only could go like six or seven innings, today he'd be great, he'd be an ace. But in the 80s, he, you know, labored in the later innings and couldn't finish a lot of games. So that to me was kind of the reason, if I had to pick one, why I put him in the honorable mention.
I think Ron Darling being such a humble individual overall is like part of the reason he's so underrated as a Met, because if you listen to him as a broadcaster talk about his own career, you'd think he was like mediocre the way he talks about himself.
He's got big fourth starter energy, but is like decidedly not a fourth starter by any other measure.
Yeah, no, he was like the number two guy behind Gooden. And yeah, he is very humble. And I think other people may say that the fact that he is so beloved and he's so present now in the booth that maybe he's overvalued now. We think of his career like more than it was. And then you talk to him and he kind of downplays it. So there's that balancing out effect right there.
Well, and another thing that I noticed as a recurring theme is that pretty much throughout their entire existence, the Mets just don't support their pitchers with run support. Like Matlack, Kuzman, Jake, like they're all in the same boat here.
It is. It's everyone talks about Jake not getting a lot of support, but it's been a tradition in Mets history. I mean, even Seaver didn't get a lot of run support. No. In the mid-70s, they were just not scoring, and that was part of the contention for Tom Seaver, for why he wanted to, why he wanted to leave, because the Mets weren't they weren't getting a lot of good hitters in the lineup that could give him more chances at victories. But John Matlack in 1974, I think this is how I start his entry, was like the Jacob DeGrom of 1974. He had a great year. His ERA was fantastic. He had a losing record, and he had and this was, you know, back in the day when Cy Young voters, they kind of looked at wins more than anything, did not even recognize him, when probably today they might give him a little more love, just saying, hey, look at his stats, and he didn't get a lot of support. They might actually vote for him. But yeah, Matlack, his record is I think 1/500. And his ERA is very good. And it's like a little over 3. It's like among the best in Mets history. But run support he got royally screwed a lot of times.
Yeah, I think you said, I think it was him. It was either him or Kuzman who pitched into the 10th inning and lost Like, it was like a 10th inning, 1-0 loss.
Yeah, that was kind of the coup de grace of it was like the cherry on top of John Matlack's 1974 season. It was, he would probably just after the game just threw his hands up and go, I can't do anything.
Invest in offense, Mets.
Mets, no.
Never.
Mets to fans, no.
So you talked about Seaver a little bit, and having actually like done the analysis and all the research for this book, is Seaver actually the best Met in the franchise's history?
Yeah, without question. I mean, not just when you consider the numbers, which are tremendous in their own right. I mean, in just about every category that matters, he is first. But it's also, it takes into account his impact on the Mets organization. That says a lot about why he's still the greatest Met. I mean, when he came to the Mets, basically through the luck of the draw in 1966, up to his rookie year, and then through the championship season of 1969, there was no player that had the impact he had on transforming the organization from just a bottom feeder every year, a perennial loser, to not only a contender, but a championship team. That type of impact, with all due respect to a guy like Jacob deGrom, who is, if you compare the two through their first six seasons, Jacob deGrom is not only on par, but is like slightly better. But the type of impact that Tom Seaver brought is something Jacob deGrom can't really do, because it's just the time period in which he's doing it, in which Tom Seaver did it, from bringing the Mets from basically, you know, a laughing stock to more than respectability. Jacob deGrom, you know, even if he wins a championship, wins another Cy Young, it's not something that he could match, despite the fact that he may have numbers that could be better than Tom Seaver.
Yeah, today I was watching, the SNY is doing a Pete Alonso day today. Yeah. And they just like played a bunch of like highlight games from his rookie season. And during the broadcast, they replayed an old interview with Tom Seaver. I think it was from 2012, where he talked about how Gil Hodges is a lot of the reason why the Mets kind of got on the map as a franchise and got respectability as a franchise. And it was really nice to see Tom Seaver, you know, give all the credit to Gil Hodges and not, you know, without acknowledging how big of a role he himself played in it. He said that was all Gil, and I took all the skills that he taught me about being a professional to the field for the Mets and wherever I went after that. So that was really, really nice.
Yeah. No, that Seaver, like a lot of the Mets of that time, especially the 69 Mets, they look at Gil Hodges reverentially. I mean, the impact that he, if Tom Seaver is the most impactful player during that time in that transitional period, I mean, Gil Hodges is the most important person in terms of the impact that he not only gave to the team, basically saying, in a sense, you know, no one's going to laugh at us anymore. But the influence he had on the 1969 Mets to be champions, I mean, that's something, you know, managers today can't really do that. But Gil Hodges, the way he just maneuvered lineups and was a guiding force. I mean, you could hear it today, like Seaver said in 2012, like guys like Jerry Kuzman, Bud Harrelson, they talk about, you know, Gil Hodges, like, and they talk about the impact he had. It's reverential.
Is Gil Hodges the manager of the All-Star Mets?
Yes, he is. Yes. For that reason that I just gave. I mean, with all due respect to Davey Johnson, most wins in franchise history, I can't see another manager doing what Gil Hodges did to that 1969 Mets team. That's how important he was to that the success of that team. And who knows what would have happened. I mean, sadly, passed away right before the 1972 season began. I mean, who knows what would happen after that.
I think Bobby Valentine is your runner-up for the managers.
Yeah, so I use the two honorable mentions as coaches, like you would normally do in an All-Star game. So Davey Johnson and Bobby Valentine got that. It was pretty easy. I think when you look at the top three managers in Mets history, they really stand out above the rest. So Bobby Valentine would who was a coach and a player for the Mets. you know, we would, he would keep the, he would be a very entertaining just being on the bench, I think, in this hypothetical team.
The Mets have not been a blessed franchise in the manager category, unfortunately.
No.
Not Team Terry?
No. I like Terry Collins maybe more than other people. I think he was, I think he got a, got really a broken down organization or a broken down team to inherit. And he kind of, he took it as far as he could take it. I did not approve of a lot of his managerial decisions.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, like, I think Terry Collins deserves immense credit for what he was able to achieve. But at the same time, I still think because of the, because the 2015 Mets never started like a whole era of success, and because we've had managers since then that have not been great, I think that a lot of his tenure has been subject to revisionist history on the part of some, is all I'll say about
that.
Yeah. Big bet. So what inspired you to write this book and to put together this All-Star team? Where did the idea come from?
The idea came from Lions Press, the publisher. They reached out to me, I think, after I wrote my first book, Mets in Tens. And one of the chapters in that book happened to be an all-time team chapter. And they asked me, they said, hey, we're doing this series of all-time all-star books. They, last August, they came out with the Yankees book. They recently came out with a Green Bay Packers book. And concurrent to the Mets book, they came out with a Pittsburgh Pirates all-time all-stars book. So they asked me, this was right after I finished Mets in Tens, which is like April 2018. And my first, my initial reaction was, I need a break. I need to rest. Like, take my, you know, turn the motor off. And about 7 months later, I emailed the guy back and said, okay, I'm ready. And if it was still available, and it was. So probably wouldn't have thought about an idea like this. I probably would have thought about something else. But when they, you know, when someone else gives you an idea, when someone else puts an idea in front of you that you feel like you can do, I thought like this was something I had the capability of doing based on the last book. So it didn't get a lot of time to do it, but I was fortunate that I cranked it out in the limited amount of time.
And so what was the writing process like for this book compared to your first book? Were there any like lessons you took from your writing process from Mets and Tens and that you brought to this one? And did this one bring any unexpected challenges compared to the first book that you didn't see coming?
Yeah, I learned a lot definitely from I learned, you know, the mistakes I made in the process of the first book, I took and made sure not to make again when I wrote the next one. This one was a little different in the sense that there were longer narratives as opposed to Mets and Tens, where I kind of wrote like 250 word, you know, just little snippets about a certain event. I had to, you know, write however many 1600, 1700 words of a particular player. So I treated them like 35 people mentioned in the book. And I made sure to treat them like 35 long form articles. And my writing process has always been like trying to put down something every day. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't, you know, it's never going to be perfect. I think that's something I struggled with in the first book. I tried to write a perfect sentence and I just sat there in front of a screen, like waiting and waiting and waiting. And a lot of times you shouldn't wait. You should just write something down and get to it later. So I made sure every day for, you know, however long, 8-9 months to just write something down. And, you know, whether it's, you know, 200 words, 500 words, 1,000 words, put something down. You can always get back to it later. And that's how I manage my time this time around. And I think I planned out my process of writing this book a little better than I did the last one.
So did you have an idea of like who you already wanted to include, or did you just let the research go where it may?
So when I started, I jotted down guys, like I jotted down the players I thought would be on it. And I'll be honest, I initially put like, you know, a 4-man rotation or a 5-man rotation and a, you know, a bullpen. And then I looked and I'm like, I really don't want Armando Benitez on my all-time team. So I
was
like, let me just make this, you know, rotation a little bigger because I feel like that's deserved. And like all-star teams, I thought of it like you would a Major League All-Star game. Yeah, okay, pitchers, you're not going to put four starting pitchers or five starting pitchers. You might put six or seven. So I did that. But yeah, I wrote down guys, like I said, Daniel Murphy, I wrote down and was like, okay, maybe I'll come back to him. I had like some extra players. I think I initially thought I was going to do like a 25 player roster. And then I realized that I maybe like to expand it to what the All-Star game used to be on like 30 person roster. And I said, well, a lot of people do these kind of all-time teams. How do I make mine different aside from just trying to write interesting narratives? So I added the two coaches or the honorable mention managers. I added the GM and I added the owner just to kind of spice it up a little bit.
There was an article on Talking Chop, which is our Braves sister blog. And they had an article where they created a team out of every position's like best individual year. And I thought that was really cool. Like having like the best team possible out of like the best performance possible out of each person. And I think that book would look a lot different if it went by that. Like you would have to include like 2013 Harvey, 2012 Dickey. And I was like, huh, that's actually a really like interesting concept.
That is a really interesting idea. And it kind of ties into a little bit of my criteria for this book. Because I looked at longevity as a area of, you know, judgment, but I tried to, you know, make sure that people that had really impactful seasons, even if they or a number of impactful seasons, even if they weren't there very long, it still meant a lot in terms of the Mets fortunes of those particular years. So like a guy like John Allred only played three seasons. I gave him maybe a little more respect in terms of the first base position and as far as the roster was concerned. I didn't like say, well, he's only there 3 years and he didn't compile enough stats. I mean, he has the best, you know, batting average for not only a single season, but a career, in a Mets career. So I made sure to look at guys like that and say, hey, you know, would I rather have this guy or rather have John Allred? Well, I'd rather have John Allred as a Met playing first base as a backup at least. So that is interesting. It would be kind of fun to do a team like that. And we got a lot of time to do it now.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe that's your next book.
I don't know about that. Maybe just like a Twitter post. Like just I did a Twitter post a couple days ago. I saw an article on The Athletic and it was who's the greatest defensive player in Mets history. And I think it was narrowed down to Ray Ordonez, Keith Hernandez, and maybe Juan Lagares. I'm trying to remember. And I just off the top of my head was like, hey, what would be the all-time Mets defensive team? And I didn't realize the kind of the hornet's nest I would encounter. Not that everyone was critical, but I kind of, you know, finagled with like right field and put Carlos Beltran there just for the heck of it. And people are like, why are you doing putting Carlos Beltran in right field when he's a center fielder? I was just like, okay, I guess I can't win, but I was just kind of trying to start a conversation and I should be careful what I wish for.
Especially when it comes to Mets Twitter.
That is true.
What is your sort of Mets fan origin story? Like, how did you become a Mets fan? How did you become a baseball fan in general? What era, like, of Mets baseball did you grow up watching, and who were some of your favorite players?
So my dad has been a Mets fan since the beginning in 1962, and he kind of passed the baton to me, and I ran with it and have taken it to probably extremes that he couldn't have imagined. But I saw my first game when I was 5 years old in 1992, and we lived in New York at the time, but we moved shortly after that to Washington, D.C., or the Washington, D.C. area, which is where I am now. It's great to be in Nats country.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it sucks.
It's not the best. I have experience with that. I lived in Baltimore for 6 years in grad school. So
yeah. Luckily, my girlfriend's an Orioles fan, so I didn't get the Nats I didn't have to see it really up close. I could kind of tune it out for a bit, but
yeah.
Anyway, I moved to the DC area, and we would go up to, cause we had family up in New York. We'd go up like at least once a year to see the Mets at Shea Stadium, then Citi Field. So going back to when I started, my dad had like the 1986 video and like the 25th anniversary video. And I just was like, oh my God, these Mets are so amazing. And then I like see the actual Mets of like 92 and 93 and go, where is everybody? the first player I gravitated to was Gary Carter from seeing all those old videos. He was my favorite player at first and then took off from there with Mike Piazza. So I started loving catchers for some reason. And then went on to David Wright for no reason other than, you know, for not just the only reason being he has my last name. Great. And it's kind of weird now that I'm in my 30s to start revering players who are younger than me. And so, but even though Jacob DeGrom's like a year younger, I still have tremendous respect from the fact that he came from obscurity and now he's not only the greatest of all those Mets pitchers who came up, Harvey and Syndergaard and Wheeler and Rafael Montero, but he's like on par with Dwight Gooden and Tom Seaver now. It's really amazing. So I just have tremendous respect for Jacob DeGrom and what he has accomplished so far.
Yeah, Jacob DeGrom is definitely the favorite of many a Mets fan. And it's cool because, yeah, like you kind of think about, I'm around the same age as you, a couple years younger, but I definitely grew up with like Mike Piazza and Edgardo Alfonso in that era of Mets. And I think about how like David Wright was like a huge turning point in my fandom and like made me become like obsessed with the Mets because that was the first player that I can think of that I followed from like being a minor leaguer to being like a legend. So that was like a really
the fact that he was there. I remember watching day one in 2004, first game, and not only that, but the lead up when everyone said, "Oh, this is guy David Wright. He's you know going to be the savior in a sense, or he's going to be the franchise going forward." And you just hope for that, and he turned out to be that for at least a good chunk of time, and we only wish he could have done it for longer. But just the way he presented himself on and off the field, I mean, I have, you know, the respect I have for Jacob DeGrom, I have that and a more for David Wright and what he did and how he persevered to at least come back to play through all those injuries. So those teams I love so much. I have great fondness mainly for like the 99-2000 teams, just the fact that it was just first group of teams that were great for in my lifetime and yours as well. I remember I was watching game five of the NLCS in 1999, that the Grand Slam single game, and just like on YouTube because I wanted to, and because there's nothing else to watch. I sat there and, you know, for 5 hours and 47 minutes, just like, oh my God, like watching the actual live game replay from like the original NBC broadcast. And I'm just, you know, it's takes me back 21 years and I'm like, I'm still nervous. Why am I still nervous over this game? And the same went for that game. What was it? I broadcast it last Tuesday. The first game in New York City after September 11th, which was, I mean, it was just as emotional watching Mike Piazza's eighth inning home run as I was 19 years ago now.
Linda was providing live commentary on the last pod during that.
Yes, I was. Well, I have to say, I knew when I got to third base, it was going to be a tough read. So like, because it was the same way. I fell in love with the 99 team and Robin Ventura was the main reason why. Like, I just loved him. And to see like your hero come through for the first time, like there's like that eventually we're going to start a series of like our most memorable games. And I think that's going to be what I write about is the Grand Slam single, because that's what made me fall in love with that team. Like I loved them and I watched them the whole season, but just to see your baseball hero come through on the grandest stage for the big time for the first time is just something that leaves a mark on a kid. And then so, you know, and to that you put him and David Wright in, you know, the third base section. I don't know if you picked up on it. I haven't. But then I was like, I need to put this book down. I need to walk away. I need to like watch something funny because you mentioned, you know, the end of Shea and how Ventura came back and he walked out from right field where his Grand Slam single landed, like just feet away from where his Grand Slam single landed. And the date was the closing of Shea, September 28th, 2008. And I was like, wait a second. So then I flip back to the David Wright chapter, and his last game was September 28th, 2018. Oh. Wow. So the closing of Shea and David Wright's last game were exactly 10 years apart. And then I started thinking, I was like, David Wright was our last connection to Shea. And I was like, you know, so I was like, Shea is like really and truly closed now. Like, okay, like Beltran may have been the connection, but now we won't speak of Beltran. But so I was like, oh no. So like, before I started like bawling, I'm like, okay, I need to like put on John Oliver or something. So it was kind of funny just to see, cause I'm like, I don't know if I ever would have made that connection if I didn't see, read it in like one sitting and see those two dates back to back.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have made that connection either. I did not know that it was, I mean, had to be around the same date. I didn't know it was the exact same date. That's really interesting. And yeah. Yeah, when you talk about that Ventura moment, I mean, the whole game, that 1999 NLCS Game 5, I mean, took years off my life. And that team,
totally.
I always think about this. If that team was happening now, I probably couldn't stand them. I would be like, oh my god, because that team was just given up for dead about 10 different times, and they always like rose from the ashes, and like, oh my god, okay, they're still not done. And I think as a kid you kind of like, oh, you love it, it's like, this is so fun. But if you're like in your 30s, you're like, oh my god, this is destroying everything inside me.
The oral history of that game that Tim Britton just did for The Athletic, I don't know if you read it, but it was a really good article because they spoke to, you know, a lot of the people involved in that game. And, you know, Bobby Valentine said the same thing. And I think Al Leiter said the same thing after that game. They're all just absolutely convinced they were going to win.
I thought, well, game six, after falling down 5-0.
And coming back.
I mean, Mike got to hit that home run, I think, to tie the game. I think it was in the seventh at 7. After he hit that home run, I thought, oh my god, we're never losing again. I thought it was just destined to be the Mets' year, and of course, you know what, 3 and 4 innings later, not. But that sense of confidence after he hit that home run, I was like, this team can't lose, they can't be beaten. What's going on here? So that feeling I had during the roller coaster of emotions. I forgot what I wrote in some article. I said that the Mets, 99 Mets, was not a roller coaster. It was an entire amusement park.
That's about right. Yeah,
that sums it up.
Yeah, Linda, you mentioned the connection between David Wright's last game and the last day at Shea. And, you know, last week on the pod, we talked about the best games that we had ever been to. And I neglected to mention the fact that I was at the last game at Shea Stadium. But I didn't mention it in my best games I've ever been to because the game itself was so awful. But the ceremony was incredibly beautiful. And I remember like Tom Seaver throwing the pitch to Mike Piazza. I just like bawled my eyes out. I like couldn't take that. That was,
I'm like getting chills right now thinking about it.
That was something. So, like, even though the game itself was pretty terrible, I don't regret for a second having been there because it was really awesome to get to witness history. So that was really cool.
Yeah, to have like all these great Mets in one spot, like you're never going to see that again.
It's true. So Anthony DiComo has actually been doing a like weekly series on MLB.com. Brian, I don't know if you've been seeing them and keeping up with them, ranking the top 5 Mets at each position and putting out like Twitter polls so fans can vote. I don't know how much of it you've seen, but have you noticed any key differences between his takes and yours and the public's takes and yours?
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of it. And, you know, understandably, we have a lot of, free time to come up with these kind of ideas. And certainly an idea like this, even if it was my book, is going to come up eventually. So I understand why it's being done. Uh, I looked a little bit at it. I think they've done catcher, first baseman, and second baseman up to this point. Yeah. And I know the fans voted for Piazza, which I have obviously no problem with, and is what I chose for the starting catcher. I think Anthony DiComo had Piazza, then Carter, then Gary Carter, then Jerry Grody, which is the three that I put on the team. And I think that a guy like Jerry Grody, who was very important to the 1969 team, maturing the pitching staff, just a solid presence behind the plate, deserves to be recognized. And that's why I put him on the team, because his numbers are not even close to someone like Piazza or Carter. He wasn't that type of offensive player, but his defense and his leadership was so important that I felt like he needed to be recognized. And as far as first baseman, fans voted for Keith. He had Keith. I had Keith. That's an obvious choice. I think the only issue I took was with Anthony DiComo putting Ed Cranepool second, which is reasonable. This is one of the great things about doing a book like this. You can have different criteria. Like, you can say, hey, I'm going to look at someone who, you know, stayed with the Mets for a while and built up their numbers and, you know, has that kind of impact where they are beloved and they, you know, had leadership in certain categories. And in that sense, Ed Cranepool is a guy you can put as your second best first baseman. For the criteria I use, the kind of a combination of impact, stats, records, and also just the general, who would I rather have? I went with John Allrude as the backup. Because I looked at Ed Cranepool more, with all due respect, and very great guy. We all love Ed Cranepool. He was a compiler. He played, 17 seasons, I think 17 or 18 seasons with the Mets, 62-79. Very good pinch hitter at the end of his career. But he had the most hits in Mets history because he was there for a while. And I guess that speaks more to the Mets not keeping their players around.
Yep.
But and then as far as second baseman, I actually don't know if I saw that. I'm sure Alfonso got the nod from the fans if the vote has been done already.
Yes,
and if
he did.
If DiComo wrote his piece, I'm assuming it was. I actually think I did see this. I think it was Alfonso, then Murphy, then Wally Backman, which was the three that I had, and I think Jeff Kent was fourth. I didn't include him. Didn't include Jeff Kent in the honorable mention, but he certainly deserves to be recognized and was a little better than people thought. And then I think he had Felix Mion fifth, if I'm not mistaken, who I had as an honorable mention. So overall, it's pretty much parallels what I had. And I think, again, you can make different reasonings for why you're putting someone where. And I really, it's hard to have an issue with it because there are so many different ways that you can create not only a team, but create your own rankings of these positions.
So we're coming up on a big anniversary and a guy who plays heavily in your book, and that's Doc Gooden. So I was wondering what, you know, in your research and your writing, you know, what comes to mind about Doc and about his debut?
With his debut was actually pretty modest. I mean, he won the game. I think he went five innings, gave up a run on three hits. It was in Houston, and I think his parents were there. So, I mean, it was a relatively subdued opener. I guess that's what happens when you're on the road. It was subdued compared to what would become later that year, especially with games at Shea Stadium. You know, with the K corner in the left field, you know, stands, upper deck, just the event nature of games that he pitched at 19 years old was truly something to behold. I mean, I'm trying to think of what era of Mets history I would love to be a part of and love to have gone to games. I mean, that maybe 84, 85, when they were kind of coming up, that might be it, just because it was. You know, the Mets coming back out of the doldrums into respectability. And Keith Hernandez was certainly leading that on an everyday basis. But Dwight Gooden was certainly leading that on the mound every fifth day. Just, I was, you know, just blowing away opposing hitters who were, you know, 10 years older than him. And he went on to strike out 276, which is still a rookie record, win Rookie of the Year, of course, and almost won the Cy Young Award. So it's funny when you look at that debut, it just looks like kind of a regular old game. And because it's in Houston, it's in the Astrodome, didn't have a lot of fanfare. I watched the YouTube video of it, and they did make pretty big mention to it. I think Ralph Kiner compared it to the movie A Star Is Born, and I think he was quite prophetic, because Dwight Gooden was a rocket ship coming out, you know, in his first two seasons. I mean, they were remarkable. So the broadcast did make mention and did kind of hint that this was a star pitcher. But I don't think they had any idea what he would become, not only that year, but the next year.
So was he like bigger than like a Harvey's view? Was that he as anticipated as like Matt Harvey was, or were they the same? Was Doc more anticipated?
I think, I don't think Dwight Gooden's debut, like as a, you know, at Shea Stadium, was as highly touted. I think maybe today because there's more attention given to pitchers that are in the minor leagues and come up through the system, we kind of put more focus on those pitchers. I think like someone like, you know, when Mike Trout came up, it got a lot of attention, or, you know, when any kind of big game prospect starts, whether it's a pitcher or an everyday player, they get a little more attention, because I think we just generally examine the whole scope of baseball now more closely. So I think from a Mets perspective, he was certainly obviously known. I mean, he had a great end to the minor league season in AAA. I think he shot up through the minor league system and led the Tidewater team to the minor league World Series in 83. And so he was known, but I don't think he certainly didn't get the attention of like a Matt Harvey or a Zach Wheeler or a Noah Syndergaard in their first starts. But I think when you realize what young pitchers could do, a young pitcher like a Dwight Gooden, maybe after that, people gave more attention to young pitchers that could be impactful.
It's funny because another one of the Pete Alonso highlight games today on SMY featured an interview from Doc Gooden, and it was a Jacob DeGrom start. So it was mostly talking about like kind of him compared to Jacob DeGrom as being like a franchise cornerstone. And so he talked a lot about, because in that game, it was the game against the Braves where the Mets like kicked the Braves' butts, and Pete obviously hit a homer and did really well. And
wait, that actually happened? They actually beat the Braves?
Yes, they did. They kicked their butt. And Jake had pitched 8 scoreless innings, and he wanted to, and like he was going to come out of the game.
Oh, was that when Freeman and Donaldson hit back-to-back home run? Oh,
yeah, it was
that
game.
So mad.
And so they interviewed Doc Gooden during the whole like Jake didn't want to come out of the game. He wanted to come back out for the 9th and pitch the complete game. And Doc was talking about how that mentality is like what you need in a successful ace, and how, you know, nothing, you're a perfectionist and nothing is ever good enough. Like, he clearly thinks he has more, and that 8 scoreless innings isn't even good enough. So it was interesting. I think that now we look a lot more like to Doc Gooden and Jacob DeGrom comparisons, whereas when they were coming up, it was a lot more like Matt Harvey. But now, obviously, Jacob DeGrom, who had the less heralded prospect pedigree, ends up being the guy that joins the Mount Rushmore, so to speak, of Mets, along with Seaver and Gooden, as far as the Mets starting pitching.
Yeah, and you want to talk about unheralded beginnings. I mean, Jacob DeGrom, I mean, I don't think he got no fanfare in that first start, which came against the Yankees in 2014. And this is going to sound ironic, but I think he gave up 1 run and lost, you know, no run support.
So, he took a backseat to Rafael Montero. Like, Rafael Montero was the more exciting prospect at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no one thought Jacob DeGrom, I mean, he didn't really wow anyone in the minors, and, you know, they brought him in. I don't know if I'm trying to remember if that was an emergency start. I don't think it was.
I think really brought him up to go into the bullpen, and then Dylan G got hurt. So then he was replacing G.
Okay. So I should remember that, but yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, it was no one gave any second thought to, like, okay, this guy's going to, you know, not only win Rookie of the Year, but he's going to do everything that he has done so far. And it's remarkable. I think when you hear him talk, he's almost not satisfied with two Cy Youngs in a row. I mean, it's kind of amazing to hear him say that.
Yeah. A true to form, Sim Jake is in a tie, a 1-1 tie in the seventh inning.
Very Mets. Very Mets.
Poor Sim Jake or Digital Jake.
So on brand.
It really is. I mean, they were facing versus Digital Verlander, so it's kind of expected, but poor Digital Jake.
It's almost like a comfort to return to the frustration of no run support for Jake.
He lasted longer than Verlander. He just got out of the seventh inning, so we'll see if he goes back out there for the eighth.
Good stuff. So, Brian, before we close things out, I wanted to ask you, this is sort of just like not topical to the book, but topical to what's going on in baseball, or as we should say, not baseball right now. but what do you think of this new Arizona plan that's been kicking around? I want to know like what other people's takes are on it besides mine.
So, I want to see baseball return as much as all of you. It gives me almost like life in a sense to see real baseball being played no matter what. I know that Major League Baseball, they wouldn't do this if this wasn't foolproof. Like, they wouldn't just go out there hastily, I don't think, and do something or play these games in which there could be some risk. I mean, there's risk in anything you do, but you know, risk in terms of the coronavirus. So I would love to see baseball in any regard. I think every measure should be taken to try to play, because I think not only will it just create general goodwill, but it, you know, also would help advertisers. It would just help the general economy, in terms of being on TV. I think it could like mic the guys. There could be some creativity with how these games are played. I just don't, if it's at too much of a risk to the well-being of the people there, players, media or whomever else is there. I don't want that risk to be taken. I think there are a lot of factors that need to be taken into account in order for this to happen. And I know Major League Baseball is aware of that, but I heard on ESPN today, I think it was Jeff Passan was talking, because these players are going to be basically, you know, holed up, and they're just like not going to be allowed into the outside world beyond just going to and from the stadium from the hotel. And he said, you know, Mike Trout's wife is due in August. Like, is Mike Trout like not allowed to leave? Like, is he like just going to have to stay there, or is he going to, what's this? You know, there's a lot of different things to call into question. I mean, are there people with like, you know, who might be more symptomatic if, God forbid, someone had the coronavirus than other players, even though these players are young. So there are a lot of different things to consider, and I know Major League Baseball is doing it, but I don't want to see baseball played if it's going to mean too much of a risk to the livelihoods of others.
Well said.
Yeah, I saw one article. They're kind of being facetious, but they're like, how do you keep a runner on first and comply with social distancing rules?
That's true. Yeah, in order. There are a lot of different factors. I guess there's, you know, home plate collisions aren't going to be a factor anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And like they were saying, like they would have to sit like 6 feet apart in the stands instead of in the dugouts. Like, there's no way to fully protect them. Like, as long as they're on a field together, you're still exposing them. You're exposing the security guards. You're exposing the trainers. So why even take the risk at that point? I don't think it's worth it and then they were saying it would be like 7 innings and it would just be like watered down baseball in 115 degree heat. Like, nobody, it wouldn't even be good baseball.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking about this whole thing. In addition to, obviously, the risk it poses to not only players, but staff, who like definitely did not sign up for this and don't make millions of dollars. But like, not only that, I just think that the game would be so unrecognizable. Would it even be worth it? Like, it might just make me too sad. Like, I'd be like, this isn't baseball. Whatever this is, it's not baseball, and I would almost rather not have it at all. But I guess it depends on how desperate we get as the summer stretches on. I don't know.
Okay, so
I was gonna say I'm willing to wait maybe a little longer. I mean, I know that they're aiming for May or maybe even early June, but I would almost, if there's a possibility of a more realistic baseball situation in, say, August, I would rather wait for that. But again, I would almost rather them just take it easy or play it safe than to try to risk anyone's well-being.
And as soon as somebody tests positive, they're going to have to shut it down again. So yeah. I don't want them to have to start and then stop again. So, like, if you're going to do it, it has to be, you know, 100%, because then what are you going to do? Have a suspended season after 2 weeks, 3 weeks? It's not worth it.
And Arizona is not one of the states that was exactly on the ball as far as response. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
I know that seems like they're not a hotbed right now compared to, like, New York, New Jersey.
Could be.
But, like, the point is that, like, it could be later. And so we don't know.
What made them choose Arizona to begin with? Because it's hot?
Yeah, because they could play the season until, like, December if they wanted to.
Oh. All right,
and keep it all in one place, you know, and not have travel and stuff
in 115 degree weather.
Yeah, the anonymous Met said, "What was it? What was the quote? Things don't,
nothing die, like
nothing lives nothing in the desert. There. Everything dies."
Anonymous the Mets are anonymously writing poetry.
Who's the secret goth Met is what I want to know.
I know.
But I feel some strong vibes there that I want to connect with in this dark time of ours.
Strong. Who do you think it is?
I think it's
That's
Seth Lugo.
A great question. Seth Lugo wouldn't be isn't a bad choice, actually.
That's my theory, that it's Seth Lugo that said that. It's strong mid-2000s emo kid energy.
This is true.
See, I was thinking Pete because he played in the Arizona Fall League, so I assumed it was somebody intimate with Arizona.
That's
but then
fair.
Somebody else said it had big JD energy, which I can also see.
I just don't think it's a hitter for some reason. I think because the pitchers are going to be more pissed about having to do the desert situation.
I could see it being Syndergaard.
Yeah,
but he's not going to play though.
That's
my
true.
Syndergaard, it definitely sounds like something Syndergaard would say. Like, if you read the
quote. If he was healthy, I would say it would be Syndergaard. But then somebody else made the good point that he would put his name on it.
Yep, I think he would put his name on it. I don't think he'd be an anonymous.
He would just post it on Twitter.
Yeah, he would just tweet it. Exactly. And that's how I feel about Stroman, too. Like, it's also something Stroman would say, I think. But I think he would just tweet it.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas I think Seth Lugo's a little more, like, private and subdued. And so it seems like inner brooding, like inner secret brooding of Seth Lugo. I don't know.
Who is Mike Puma on speed dial?
Yeah, that's the other thing. You have to think of like which Mets would call Puma, which I don't know. But
yeah, I don't know either because I feel like they would call like one of the younger guys if it was like a JD, or they would just tell Gelbs.
Yeah.
Does for better or for worse, he does have that hustle, and I could see him rattling off a text to every single Met in the first like 10 seconds after the story dropped.
So what do you think?
and getting the feedback that way.
Yeah, for real. So if you guys have if you listeners have alternative theories about which Met you think it is, drop it in our replies on Twitter. We'd like to hear all your conspiracy theories about which Met gave the anonymous emo quote.
This is all we have right now.
This is literally all we have. We're going to close the show on a happy note like we do every
hell
week.
Yeah, Jake had 12 strikeouts. Yes. And he left with the win. He can get the win. It's 2-1 now. And the Kansas is in the game.
Excellent. That is such good news. We're going to close the show out like we do every week with walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball-related or otherwise. Brian Wright, what is your walk-off win?
So today, and I guess maybe as we're speaking, I don't think the game broadcasted ended, but they are streaming on MLB the Johan Santana no-hitter. And I really enjoy, I'm going to try to watch it if I can, the end of it at least. But I have a quick story about how I saw the ending. As I said, I'm in Washington, D.C., and I was supposed to go to the Nationals-Braves game that night for no really good reason. And we're driving to the game. It starts pouring. We don't really have tickets. We're just going to get them there. So it starts pouring, and we're in traffic, and we all decide to turn around, me and three other friends. And I realized I had forgotten my cell phone. And I said, oh, well, whatever. I'll just, you know, just get it when I get home. And we go to a restaurant with no TV. And I don't know what's going on. No one tells me. And after we have dinner, we go to a bar in a suburb of DC. And I walk into the sports bar with a bunch of TVs and I see the game being played. It's the seventh inning. And Mike Baxter makes this great catch. And I see the score. And I go, ah, it's too bad he didn't make that in a closer game. Then I wait for the inning to end. And of course, you see the Lions score and I go, oh my goodness. And I happen to catch the last two innings, watching it with, you know, no sound, but at least I got to see it. So it was quite prophetic that, or it was quite fortuitous, I should say, that the rains came.
Yeah, otherwise you would have been at a game and you wouldn't have been able to see it.
I would have been at a game. I guess someone might have said something. It was kind of interesting. I like never, knock on wood, never lost my cell phone. Like I maybe once or twice in my life. And that's the one time.
They might have shown it on the scoreboard because I remember I was at Citi Field when Hamels threw the no-hitter on the Cubs and they turned it on in the Promenade Club. And so I actually got to see Hamels, but I did not. I actually have a funny story about Johan Santana's no hitter too. I went out for Mexican with my friend, and we were in just eating, and then we heard a commotion coming from the bar, and we kept hearing Santana, Santana. I'm like, what? So then, like, we heard like cheering. So I was like, oh my god, does he have a no hitter? So we pulled out our phones. So we heard. So I basically watched Johan Santana's no hitter on my phone because did he do it, and then we heard cheering at the bar, and then we pulled out our phone, we're like, he did it. So that was my friend. After that, 2 years later, we were out for fondue. I pull out my phone and I have a notification saying Jacob deGrom struck out the first 8 hitters of a game when he was a rookie. And then 2 years after that, I was at her wedding. I pull up my phone and I see Bartolo Colon has hit a home run. So every time I have been with this friend, something bizarre happens with the Mets.
So you just need to hang out with this friend all the time, is what you're trying to tell me?
I think I do. We actually did. We've been to one Met game together. And it was awful. John Neese pitched against the Marlins. Giancarlo Stanton hit the longest home run I've ever seen, like, in person. Oh, no. So she's not allowed in Citi Field, but I think we just need to hang out more often.
Yeah, just at bars, restaurants, you know.
Fondue. Maybe she can, like, renew her vows. Who knows what would happen?
Oh, yeah, that'd be cool. Maybe the Mets will win the World Series.
That's true.
Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
So I'm going in a non-baseball direction because what is baseball? I'm not quite sure how much of this is getting coverage outside of New York, but at least in much of the city, every night at 7 p.m. from 7 to 7:02, everybody, and okay, not 100% of the population, but enormous number of people in our neighborhood, sticks their heads out the windows and cheers and screams and claps in appreciation of the essential workers and the healthcare providers. And, you know, this is, I live in Northern Manhattan. We're tucked in between two major hospitals, including New York, like the enormous New York Presbyterian at Columbia, which has a huge, huge number of COVID-19 patients. And it's just like, it's become the loveliest tradition. And I love it, especially for our neighborhood, for a couple of different reasons. And one is that, like, this is a loud neighborhood. This is a neighborhood that likes its music, that hangs out outside and chats all night long. This is, and you know, there's lots of drivers around because it's near some highways. This is like a bustling neighborhood, and it's so quiet now. And it like just, it just, the silence, like except for, you know, an ambulance siren every like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. It's really heartbreaking to hear it just so still. But this is like the one time every night when everybody just lets loose. And there are people with noisemakers. There are folks like driving in circles around blocks in their car, like leaning on the horn. Like it is just like this enormous explosion of sound. And then also it is so close to the hospitals, and at least one of them, at least Allen Hospital, has definitely like every night hears us. And that just warms my heart. And the kids love it. I spend all day shushing them. Number two voice. Like, and this is where I could be like, all right, scream. And you know, it's just wonderful. And I hope every city starts doing it, because it feels good. It's a release. There's also, if you want to read a little bit more, you know, on the ground about it, there was a Washington Post article a couple days ago, but it's one of those things that just makes me proud to live where I do. And it's like, it's the tiniest thing that we can all do, but we can all do it. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really awesome. It's been awesome to see all the videos of it, because I've seen some videos of it in New York, but also in a couple other cities too. And I've seen it in the UK also, even. So it's been cool to see.
Italy started it, I think.
Yeah, Italy did it as well.
Yeah. I think Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah, but because then, like, you know, you kind of feel so helpless. Like, how can you help? And at least that's, like you said, it's the, you know, it's a tiny gesture, but at least it's something. And I really do hope it's getting through, and the everybody on the front lines really does know how appreciated they are during all this.
And, you know, it's a unifying force also, because earlier this evening, this one rando Karen logs into our neighborhood Facebook group and is like, ugh, everybody should spend as much energy donating all of their hoarded medical supplies as they do cheering. I'm like, first of all, the folks hoarding medical supplies are not cheering. But no. Moreover, I have never seen a neighborhood group smackdown descend so quickly and decisively. Like, nobody had any time for her bullshit. There were like 100 people, including like our kind of crotchety old neighborhood group moderator, were just like, nope, not having it. We are the best. This is wonderful. You hush.
Yeah. Awesome. It's great. Yeah. A very close friend of mine is a medical lab tech at a major New York City hospital. And his friends reached out to the Mets, and Pete Alonso recorded him a personalized video. And I saw it on Facebook last night, and I almost cried. I was like, this is the best thing ever. And he's obviously, like me, a huge Mets fan. That was like the thing that brought us together in college, is that we were both like the biggest Mets fans that each other knew on campus. And so like, you know, it was just so awesome to see, because I know how much that must have made his entire day, week, month, year to see.
Life.
So that was really cool.
Oh, Pete. He's such a treasure.
Pete's been awesome during this. Like,
he really has. Good.
He's such a good egg, you guys.
I know. How do we look into David Wright and then him?
I know, right? Like, just
by unlucking through every other part of it. I
know. Literally everything else. Gotta balance it out somehow. So Linda Cervich, what is your walk-off win for this week?
I know last week my walk-off win was my best friend's baby being born. And now this week I got two more texts saying two more babies were born.
We're of that age.
Yeah. There's probably going to be a baby boom in 9 months, but I'm going through my own baby boom right now. So a good friend from high school, she had her second, a baby boy, And my cousin had his first baby girl. He had two boys, and now this is his first girl. And the first girl in that family, because his sister had two boys, so there was four boys in that family. So now this girl is going to have a lot on her plate growing up. But yeah, it was just nice, like, to be surprised, like, you know, seeing, hey, look, Allison is here. And it's just, like I said last week, it's nice to know life is still going on and life is still happening. And, you know, it's not all bad because, you know, you just hear the constant, you know, how many more have infected, how many, you know, well, just the numbers are just staggering and just so hard to comprehend. So just to get like a little boost like that of a newborn. And they'll have like their whole lives ahead of them, and their parents are gonna have quite a story to tell them about when they were born. But yeah, it was just it's you need stuff like that, like a break from all the bad news. So congratulations to my cousin and to my friend Terry, and seems like everybody, mom, baby, families are doing well. So much love to all of them.
That's great. Baby's name is Allison. Good name. I approve.
Yes, yes, she is. Allison Elizabeth.
Highly approved by me.
Yes.
best name ever, in my opinion. So my walk-off win for this week is that I got to watch Onward on Disney+, and it was a great movie.
Basically, want to see it so bad.
Basically, don't have much more to say than that. But yeah, I had been looking forward to it because I knew that because of everything that's going on, obviously the movie theaters aren't open. And so movies are being dropped to be streamed instead of, you know, being in theaters. And so I had been looking forward to this movie for a long time because I love Disney Pixar. Who the heck doesn't? And I had been seeing trailers for this movie like long before, you know, all of this went down. And so I was planning on seeing it in theaters when it came out. But instead, obviously, the world is very different now. And so I happened to have Disney+. I had it already. I'm lucky enough that I got a year of it for free because of my Verizon like phone plan. Like FYI, like PSA, if you have a Verizon like unlimited data phone plan, you can get a year of Disney+ for free. Through Verizon. So that's pretty cool. So I'm on my year of free Disney+. And so, yeah, on Sunday, I watched Onward with my parents and with Michael, and I really enjoyed it. It was really good. I wouldn't like necessarily rank it among like the top five Pixars because obviously like that's an impossible list to crack. But like it was definitely like it exceeded my expectations. I'll put it that way. Like I didn't have like super high expectations. Like I had high expectations because it's Pixar, and like obviously anything Pixar has like a minimum of expectations that are there already, just inherent in it being Pixar. But I wasn't like, oh, like this has to be the next WALL-E or the next Up or I won't be happy. And it was like even better than I thought. I really enjoyed it. And I felt feelings I did not expect to feel because it's Pixar. So, of course, it's going to make you cry. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it was nice to like watch something new for once instead of like, you know, which show should I binge that came out a while ago that I just never got around to seeing? Like, this was actually a new thing that debuted that I got to watch. Like, what do you know about that? So, yeah, very simple, but that's my walk-off win for this week.
The Digital Mets won. Betances, yes! And Diaz closed it out. There was a scary moment, but JD Davis ran down a ball right at the wall against Edwin Diaz, but 2-1, Jacob deGrom got the win and Diaz got the save.
Really the dream Mets game that you would hope the 2020 Mets would have.
Yeah.
Liked one where Diaz didn't make it interesting, but let's not get ridiculous.
I mean, he didn't give up any hits. Like, it was at, like, where the hill would have been. Like, that's where they hit it to.
I see.
But JD did. So, DeGrom's final line was, Digital DeGrom's final line was 7 innings pitched, 4 hits, 12 strikeouts, 1 earned run, and 4 walks.
Awesome. That is solid. Good stuff. Yep. Good job, Digital Mets.
Oh, Digital. Yeah, go get that Digital Cy Young, Digital Jake.
Yeah. Amen. Three-peat. So while you're waiting for the next pod to drop, you should order Brian's book, The New York Mets All-Time All-Stars. Brian, where can people order this book since they can't physically go to a bookstore right now?
Yes, good point. Yeah, they can go to Amazon or any major online retailer. If anyone wants a signed copy, I'm happy to provide one, obviously with payment, of course. You can reach me at BrianWright86. You can DM me, and I'm happy to send one to you.
Fantastic. You can also go to AmazonAvenue.com, check out all of our fantastic content. Chris McShane is messing around with digital mets of his own. and we are providing game commentary like we normally would for the site for the digital mets. We're also dropping various other fun features like Vaz's March Badness bracket, which is in the finals now. Is the final vote finished or not yet? I don't remember.
I think it ends Thursday.
It ends Thursday. The final vote. It's Chase Utley against the Wilpons. So pick your worst Mets villain between those two. Yeah, it's an epic final. So,
but it's kind of a runaway right now. I was kind of surprised.
I'm surprised that the vote is lopsided as it is. But we're not going to give away which direction it is lopsided because I don't want to influence the voters. So, yes, go to AmazingAvenue.com, vote on the March Badness. Check out Chris McShane's feature, Digital Mets. We're going to have various other fun features for you, like best Mets games we've ever been to, favorite players, all sorts of other stuff to fill the time while we're waiting for baseball to come back. You can follow the site on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I'm at Petite PhD. How about you, Linda?
At Linda Servich.
And you, Maggie?
Maggie162.
So follow all of us and Brian on Twitter. And you should rate and review the podcast after you hit the subscribe button. Please, please rate and review the podcast. It really helps folks find the show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. The original intro and outro music to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. Don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.